We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me once again. And on this episode, I'm delighted to be covering Francois Truffaut's 1959 film, The 400 Blows, or in the original French, I think it's Les 400 Coups. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. Just basically, I wanted to keep branching out with the podcast, wanted to keep covering some different things, and I thought it'd be nice to turn a spotlight for once on some non-English language cinema. So I thought this was a good place to start. Such an interesting film. French New Wave, such an interesting movement. And joining me to discuss the film, a woman who needs no introduction for long-term listeners of this podcast, certainly, is Raquel Stetcher. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back. I'm so excited to talk about The 400 Blows.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. It's been a while. I think it was around Christmas time, wasn't it? We were together talking about Going My Way and The Bells of St. Mary's. Bit of a different proposition today, but it's a good one. I really think it is. Where should we start, Raquel? I mean, just in general, you're a big fan of non-English language cinema, aren't you? So I thought it would be good to have you here for this one.
Yes, and I'm trilingual, so I speak English, Spanish, and Portuguese, and I know a little bit of French too. So I like to practice my languages by watching movies and TV shows in Spanish and Portuguese. But I also really love stories from around the world. I like to see different cultures and hear different languages and see, just get different perspectives. So one of the things I focus on my blog that's about new movies is I try to make sure I cover as many international films as I can and from as many continents as I can, not just like Europe or just like, you know, just Spanish speaking countries, just as much as possible. And then one thing I've been trying to do this year, which I have a slow start to, but I'm going to pick it up again, is I want to watch as many of the best international Oscar winning films as I can. And some of them are not very readily available, but a lot of them are. So I'm trying to start from the beginning and kind of work my way towards the present. I thought that would be a good challenge.
That's interesting. So how do the Oscars, do they, you know, are there certain nations that do really well for the foreign language film Oscar?
Yeah, I think the ones that have won the most have been like Italy, Japan, and France. Spain as well.
Countries with very strong film cultures, I guess.
Yeah, especially at the beginning, when you look at the very early history of the what it was known back then as the best foreign language film, it was almost exclusively Italy, France, and Japan, because they were having such, like, they were in their golden age of filmmaking at the time in that post-World War II era. So there were some really just amazing filmmakers, and especially out of France with the French New Wave. So it just made sense that they would catch attention over here in the United States.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of leads me to my next point, really, which is just the general bit of chat on Francois Truffaut specifically and the French New Wave or the Nouvelle Vague in particular. So, yeah, is Truffaut somebody you found yourself drawn to over the years? Have you watched like a lot of his films?
So just in terms of like French New Wave, I think I've seen more Jean-Luc Godard than I've seen Francois Truffaut. But I really do love Francois Truffaut. I love his attention to realism and to just kind of small aspects of people's lives. And I love his stories and how character driven they are. I've seen like Shoot the Piano Player, Jules and Jim, which isn't one of my favorites, but I'm trying to appreciate it more. Two English Girls, The Last Metro. I think Confidentially Yours might have been the first film of his I saw, which is interesting because it's the last film he made. But I think my point of entry there was I watched a film called Eight Women, and it starred like Catherine Deneuve and Fanny Ardant and had Isabelle Huppert in it. And I was like, oh, I want to watch more films with these actresses in it. And Fanny Ardant, who was Francois Truffaut's partner at the time, was in that final film. So that was kind of like That happens to me a lot. That's kind of my segue into things. It's like I watch something I really like and I want to watch more of either that filmmaker or the actors who are in it, and it kind of guides me there. But yeah, I really like Francois Truffaut's films, and I'm getting to know them more.
That's fairly similar for me, actually. Until recently, the only ones I had seen were The 400 Blows. I think Jules and Jim, I believe, was the first Truffaut film I saw. I remember seeing that. I was shown that in a class when I was about 16 or something. Fahrenheit 451 I've seen, and Day for Night, which is a really good film.
That is a good one, with Jacqueline Bisset.
Yeah, very good film. And for a long time, that was it, though. But then more recently, I bought a Truffaut box set. So I've seen a few more. I've seen Shoot the Pianist. Wow. The Soft Skin was a really good one. The Bride Wore Black was another. But I still got plenty of gaps to fill, so I can't really claim to be a Truffaut expert. But I would say I'm a Truffaut admirer. I think a film like The 400 Blows, I think that was a big one for me, seeing that as a teenager. I think a lot of people have felt that way over the years.
It's my favorite of his that I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, just in terms of opening your eyes to the fact, for me at that time anyway, it was sort of the mainstream films, all the American films I'd seen. They're great, but they're not the only show in town. And I think that's the kind of what I picked up at that time. There's also other things to think about when it comes to Truffaut, though, aren't there? Like the fact that I think a lot of people come across his famous essay about the auteur theory that he wrote in the 50s. I think a lot of people end up reading the Truffaut Hitchcock book, which I've talked about several times on this podcast. I always seem to quote it, even down to things like he appears in Spielberg's film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and just the whole story of the French New Wave generally. I think he's a much bigger figure even than just his filmography, which is great, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think if the French New Wave is just a really interesting time in film history, how they just broke the mold of just any type of conventional filmmaking. And then, yeah, definitely the auteur stamp of, like, you know, when you watch a Truffaut film, you know it's a Truffaut film. Watch a Jean-Luc Godard film, you know it's a Jean-Luc Godard film. He was a film critic. Truffaut was a film critic before he was a filmmaker. And he just wanted to toss out, like, pretty much every convention so that you have, like, this new style of filmmaking that's very unconventional. You have a totally different style of editing, on location shooting. I mean, Truffaut was like hitting up his film critic friends, like, "Hey, can I shoot in your apartment?" You know, there's a lot of realism because it was shot on the streets and shot in people's homes. Unconventional things in, like, how they would put, like, a camera in a basket or in a car and have it, like, follow, or how they would hide the camera and things like that. It was just a great time of invention and trying something new and different of these, like, really young filmmakers. And then they were discovering young talent, too, which is interesting with Truffaut and how he kind of finds his muse in Jean-Pierre Léaud, you know, like the star of The 400 Blows and then the series that comes after. So
yeah,
it's just really interesting how, and it's so organic too, how the French New Wave came about, how all these filmmakers just, like, and they all knew each other. They worked together. Yeah. how it just came about is just a super interesting time period with films that are just, like, mind-bogglingly good or sometimes just very bizarre.
Well, that's what... Do you think Truffaut is quite a good place to start then for somebody who doesn't really know about the French New Wave?
Yes, I would say like The 400 Blows is a better entryway into the French New Wave than maybe, like, Breathless is also a good entryway because you kind of get like, oh wow, this is a really unique style of filmmaking. But I wouldn't start with something like Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend. Have you seen that? That is like one of the most bizarre, messed up movies. Like, you want to start with something like that, or like Jacques Demy. You know, he's a good place to start as well. But Truffaut, I think, would be really, especially early Truffaut, like a Jules and Jim or the 400 Blows, would be a really great introduction into French New Wave.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people are drawn to Truffaut or Godard, and I think Truffaut is more accessible than Godard is.
Yes.
I do think he has made some excellent films, but I could see somebody in 2021 sitting down to watch something like Breathless, and Breathless is quite accessible for him, but I could still see it being a bit of a head-scratcher in some ways, and I think definitely when you get to later Godard films, like you say, they get a bit more arcane, don't they? And his politics kind of comes right up into the foreground and things like that. Yeah.
And now he's just making these weird art installation movies with like shapes and sounds and things. I mean, I haven't seen any of them, but they pop up at film festivals. So he's still like, he's in isolation, still making movies. You know?
it's a few years. I saw his 3D film. I think it was 2014 or something like that. Goodbye to Language. And I didn't understand any of it.
Oh.
It was just nice to know he's still doing stuff like that. You know, still.
What kills me about François Truffaut is the fact that we lost him so early, because I know that when he passed away, he was kind of trying to wrap up his filmmaking career, but I feel like he was such a champion for movies, even though he started off as like this really outspoken critic of movies, just tearing stuff down, but he just absolutely loved cinema, like from a very young age, and was just a big champion for cinema. And I feel like had he lived on, he could have made some more great films, or he could have supported some filmmakers. And he's unique in that aspect. Like there's a lot of really great filmmakers, but how many filmmakers have a love of cinema like him? Like I can name a few, like Martin Scorsese or Barry Jenkins or Ava DuVernay or something like that. But yeah, François Truffaut was special, and it pains me that we lost him before we could have seen a lot more from him.
Because he was only, what, was it 52 when he died? Something like that. Like, really young. Yeah, sad.
And Jean-Luc Godard is still with us, you know? So, like, why not Truffaut? Yeah,
in his 90s, yeah. But like I say, yeah, I think Truffaut is a more comprehensible filmmaker than Godard is. I think his films are rich with, like, humanity, aren't they? So I think if you start off with something like The 400 Blows, if you're having a look at The French New Wave, you do get a real sense of what these films were about and some of the traits of them, and we'll talk about some of this. But you should have an emotional experience too, I think, because it's a very lovely film. But yeah, obviously they're not the only show in town, Truffaut and Godard. You could go and watch an Agnès Varda film, or you could watch some by Eric Rohmer. But Truffaut is a great place to start, I think. Yeah, what about The 400 Blows then, Raquel? I mean, if there are people listening to this podcast who don't know about this film, or maybe they've only just heard about it, what do you think of the basics here? What's the film about? How would you pitch it to people who haven't seen it before?
So The 400 Blows is a very autobiographical feature film, the first, François Truffaut's first feature film. And it tells a story about a young boy. He's about 12 years old. His name is Antoine. And he is just experiencing a lot of bad luck. He's not a bad kid, but he's also not a good kid either. He kind of skirts the line between both. But pretty much everyone in his world is very, like all the adults in his world are just completely misunderstand him. So if you ever were a child who felt misunderstood, this is the movie for you. That's why I gravitate to it so much. So we follow his misadventures, you know, in school, at home, and then eventually it leads him into essentially incarceration. And the thing is Truffaut took his experiences and the experiences of his best friend growing up, another film critic, Robert Lachenay, he kind of put their stories together of real stories that happened over 5 years, shrunk it down to a few days, and put it into this movie. And then when they cast Jean-Pierre Léaud, they also did some edits to the script. Because he was very different from Truffaut, so you get out of this is you get a story of a young boy who's misunderstood, and you follow his misadventures. But what's interesting about this is that it's so autobiographical to Truffaut's life, and it's so specific. It's like how they say the more specific you get, the more universal you get. That's the strength of this. Like Truffaut, in making the film, was worried that the film was gonna seem whiny and self-indulgent, and the opposite happened. Like people who watch this film are just either horrified or they connect to it personally. They're like, "Wow, I remember when adults didn't believe what I was saying, or I had to lie to get out of this, or I was publicly humiliated in front of my classmates, or you know, those things happen." Yeah, so it's an autobiographical story about a young boy who's just misunderstood, and basically it's about his misadventures.
And I feel like it captures something very truthful about that, you know?
Yes.
That feeling about what it's like to be young, like 12, 13 years of age. Mm-hmm. It's that age when you're kind of in between, aren't you? Because you can see with Antoine that he's still very childish in some ways. But of course, you've got these inevitable changes that are coming as you go through adolescence. And I think it comes through very clearly in the film, because I was sat there last night thinking, you can see how boyish he still looks, you know, how young he still seems. You know, when he goes on that fairground ride where he's spinning around.
Yes.
And he's got that kind of giddy pleasure in it. And he just looks really kind of childish and young. But on the other hand, he's also someone who, you know, when he talks to the psychologist, he's talking about wanting to sleep with women and all of that.
And he also talks about trying to get a job, too. Like, I don't want to do school anymore. I just want to make a living. So, yeah, he is caught in a sort of purgatory between childhood and wanting to be an adult, especially wanting to be an adult and escape these awful adults in his life who are controlling him. But he's still too young to escape it. So, yeah, it's an interesting time period.
Well, that's what happens all through the film, isn't it? He kind of fluctuates between him being quite hemmed in certain settings, and then in others he's much more free and he's much more liberated. And again, that, I don't know about you, something about that feels very truthful to me when I think back to my own sort of experiences of that age. Not that they were quite like Antoine's. I don't know, that's kind of what I think a lot of the value is of this film, is this boy who doesn't quite fit in, doesn't quite know his place in the world yet, and it's just a very warm, empathetic portrait of him, isn't it? Which I think is the main thing I take away from it.
It does a great job showing the point of view of him as a child, and also of the other children too. You kind of get a sense that you are in the world of this child experiencing what he's experiencing, which he does so well. And he does it, Truffaut does this really well in just small scenes, that just like the centrifuge ride, like you mentioned, just seeing his joy of like being on that ride, or him playing hooky with his friend and just going to the cinema. But there's also like some small moments, like I just thought it was so interesting how Truffaut takes so much time showing him taking out the trash. Like Antoine, like his mom's like, go take out the trash. So like you see him, he walks to the kitchen. He opens the cupboard. He takes out the bucket. He walks down his flight of stairs. Like Truffaut really takes his time to show that scene. And then when you look at the ending where he's running towards the beach, also it takes its time. Like you see him escape from the fence, you see him go under a bridge, you see him run down a road. Like it takes its time, and I think that's a strength of the film, and that's what makes us connect to it so much, is that we're not at arm's length. We're right there with this character, and we're taking the time to really see the big things that happen and the small things. And I think that just creates like a comprehensive portrait that makes him like an empathetic character. Like we've experienced this, the highs and lows and everything between.
Yeah, I think I showed this film to my son last night, who's 13, and I'm just curious what he would make of it, because I feel like it's a good age to experience the film, but it's also quite a departure for somebody who, you know, he loves Marvel, he loves Star Wars, he loves all the things that are big these days, you know. And he didn't hate the film, but he struggled with, he was like, I don't really know what this film is supposed to be about. But I think it's that slice of life kind of aspect of it, which he's not really accustomed to. He's accustomed to plot, 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 you know, and that's not really what you get.
And you get like, today you get like rapid cuts and lots of action and things happening really fast. This film takes its time, you know. Yeah. It's like, it's under 2 hours, but it feels like it's a slow roll, which, you know, if you're not used to that, that could be, especially for, you know, a 13-year-old who might be not used to something like that, might be something to get used to.
I think so, but he didn't hate it. If he'd have hated it, he'd have told me for sure.
Oh, good. I'm glad that he enjoyed it at least.
What do we know about the sort of backstory here? I think, I mean, you've already mentioned that it's seen as a very autobiographical film. I just one thing to kick us off here. I thought this was fascinating that François Truffaut had been banned from the 1958 Cannes Film Festival. So he had insulted an important official, apparently. And there's some quote where he called the festival a failure. So he became persona non grata. And then the following year, he comes back and he wins the Best Director Award for The 400 Blows.
Crazy!
So it's quite a good turnaround.
I love that story.
Yeah, so what sort of sense have you picked up then from what you've sort of read, Raquel, about exactly how autobiographical the film is?
Okay, so I've been reading the Truffaut biography by Antoine de Baquet and Serge Toubiana. I apologize if I'm butchering those names. It's a really interesting biography. I recommend it. It was recommended to me by a big Truffaut fan, a friend of mine, Kate Gabrielle, who enjoyed it too. So lots of really interesting things. Truffaut himself, like his you see so much of Truffaut in Antoine, the character. You know, his mother was, you know, very young when she had him. His father, no one really knows who his father. I think they figured out later on who his biological father was. But at the time, they didn't really know. His mother marries this man named Roland Truffaut, and that's how he gets the Truffaut name. He has a young brother who dies in infancy, so, like, his parents kind of are feeling very resentful towards him. So you have that. And then the stories of, like, that story of him at school telling the teacher that his mother died, and then his father coming in the next day and smacking him in front of everybody. That actually happened in real life. That was a true story of Truffaut's childhood, and that was the seed that planted the story. He worked that into like a 3 or 4 page story treatment and built off of that a script. And he worked with Marcel Moussy to kind of like take a lot of these stories and kind of build them into a full script. So that one real story cemented the movie and started the movie. And I thought was really interesting too is what I found out, like little things like the father figure, his stepfather had a long nose and joked around a lot and was really into mountain climbing, and they changed it into like car racing in the movie.
Car racing, yeah.
Yeah. So he found an actor who looked like his dad and gave him the characteristics of his dad. And he also, like, I think the actress had to go blonde too. And he gave her characteristics of his mom. I just think that's super interesting. And I also read that at the time, François Truffaut, when he was making this film, he was having marital issues with his first wife, Madeleine. And he actually got funding for the movie from his father-in-law because his father-in-law thought if he helped his son-in-law with this film project, that it would help their marriage.
All right.
So that's when François Truffaut had to write that 3 or 4 page treatment, you know, present it to his father-in-law to get funding for the movie. I thought that was super interesting. And just one other thing, before he made this movie, this was his feature film debut. He made a short film. What is it called again? The Mischief Makers. It's like a 19-minute film. I watched it the other day. It was interesting. It's about these young kids, these like very insolent young children. Like, in fact, they're infatuated with this adult woman, and they're following her around. But she has a boyfriend, so they're trying to like basically sabotage their relationship. And it's really interesting. And it's interesting that he made that short movie about these kids. These mischief-making kids, and then he goes to make the 400 Blows. But what's interesting, too, is that I guess in France at the time, you couldn't just become a film director. You had to actually go through this protocol of, like, you had to be an assistant director on a few films. You had to do X, Y, and Z. He actually got around that with just, like, the short films that he made and pulling some connections with his film critic connections, I guess. And he got to make his feature film debut with the 400 Blows. So there's lots of really interesting backstory about this movie.
Yeah, there is, because I picked up on a few things too. And so Truffaut, when he would have been the age Antoine is in the film, that would have been in 1945, I believe. So kind of a different context, 1945 France, when you're, you know,
just after the war,
the liberation of Paris and all that. Yeah. And this, the film is set, I believe, in 58. So the timeline's changed, but it's set, is it in the same neighborhood where he grew up? Mm-hmm. I think the apartment's supposed to be reminiscent of where he grew up in some ways. Like you say, all the things with Antoine, like Truffaut loved Balzac as well, and Antoine does in the film, I guess. Yes. And things like that. Yeah. I'd read that in 1947, Truffaut was sent to a center for delinquent minors. Mm-hmm. He had been arrested for running a cinema club with stolen money. Is that what it was? And I believe he was friends by then, like you say, a lot of these people all knew each other, who mm-hmm. became like well known afterwards. He was friends with the film critic André Bazin, and he was said to have saved Truffaut from a couple of situations like that. I think later, when Truffaut went AWOL from the French army in 1951, Bazin helped him out there and gave him some shelter. But you see in the film, don't you? I think there's a dedication to Andre Bazin. He died on the first day of shooting. Yeah, which is kind of a sad
Because he passed away before the film released. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and he gets a lot of help from his film critic friends from Cahiers du Cinéma. One film critic friend is actually playing the lover, the mother's lover that Antoine sees when they're kissing in the street, you know?
Right.
So that's a film critic friend. Another film critic friend lent him an apartment to use for some of the scenes. So he used a lot of his connections, which I thought were really interesting. I mean, this is like filmmaking is not a one-person job.
Quite
you
fraternal.
Know, like, yeah, you kind of need this network of people. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I think so too, yeah. And I'd seen a quote from Truffaut from 1957. He had said, tomorrow's, obviously, like you said, they were kind of pushing against what French cinema was like at that time. And he said, tomorrow's film will resemble the person who makes it. Tomorrow's film will be an act of love. So they didn't like how impersonal a lot of French films were before that. They were often, you know, quite literary, and they felt that the scriptwriter was more important than the director, and so on and so forth.
And I had read too that when Truffaut was getting into movies, there's a gap in World War II where a lot of the French films were, you know, not being shown in the cinema. They were kind of banned because of Nazi occupation of France. And a lot of American films were held back. And then you get post-World War II, and then all these movies just kind of flood the cinemas. Yeah. And so François Truffaut is taking in a lot of cinema at once. And this is also around the time period where we get, you know, the French, you know, watching all of our film noir and saying, oh, look, there's a theme here. There's like an aesthetic. There's like this, you know, this kind of like subgenre of film. So I think it's interesting. His education kind of comes all at once where he's devouring hundreds and hundreds of movies. And by the time he makes The 400 Blows, he said he had watched like 3,000 movies, and some he had watched dozens of times, because he, like in the movie, he and his friend would just sneak into a cinema and sometimes spend all day there instead of going to school. And they'd watch movie after movie. So I think it's a really interesting education. And then, like, did you get the French New Wave and how it just, like, they got exposed to all of these movies. They're like, we could do something different.
Yeah, it sounds heavenly, doesn't it, having that kind of film upbringing like that.
And oh, yeah.
Just seeing them in that kind of that fashion, so one after the other.
Kind of reminds me of how Martin Scorsese talks about his childhood when he was like very sickly, and the cinema was somewhere safe where he could be. So he was just watching movies and movies and movies, and yeah, like that has a huge impact.
The interesting thing to me, I think, with this in terms of how autobiographical it is that apparently in interviews when the film was released, Truffaut often contradicted himself. So he would say nothing in this film was exaggerated, you know, like it is very truthful. And then sometimes he would deny that it was autobiographical. And I don't know if you've read anything about his relationship with his mother, but I wonder if that's because he was trying to preserve the relationship with his parents, because they don't really come off that well in the film itself, do they? So I wonder if that was part of it.
I was curious about that. I did read a lot about him, his relationship with his parents growing up, and it was not good. Like, his mother was very resentful of him. Treated like, you know how in the film they're like, okay, how do we get rid of him for the summer? That's something that actually happened. Like, how do we get rid of this kid? And for a while he was being raised by his grandmother, and then his grandmother died, and then they got stuck with him again. They got stuck, like, you know, he didn't have a good relationship. I did hear that when the film came out, there was some pushback from his parents. So maybe that's why he's like, oh, wait, no, not everything happened. But just in reading the biography of his early days, I mean, even down to the mother having a lover, that actually happened. I read a story about how when he was living with his grandparents, the mother and father would come over, and then the lover would come over and bring a bottle of wine to the husband and something, and like a book for his mistress. And I'm like, even those, like, he put a lot of things from his childhood, like you said, you know, how he was fascinated with Balzac. He read Balzac as a child. He even read books as a child because that meant he could be quiet, and that's when his mother was nicest to him, when he was quiet. So he, like, took in a lot of literature at the time, and there were a lot of books around. So these stories, like, when you read his biography, or you learn about his childhood, it's like you could start making connections to the 400 Blows kind of all over the place. So it can't not be autobiographical.
Yeah, well, I was wondering what you sort of see as the main themes of this film, or what some of the main social problems you think that we see are. And I think the family unit definitely has to be one, doesn't it? Because it really does seem like a dysfunctional family in a lot of ways, doesn't it? I mean, they do have that nice scene at the cinema, after the cinema, when they come out and everything seems a bit more lighthearted and happy. But like you say, other than that, there are lots of issues, like the mother's having. She seems quite manipulative, the mother, in some ways, doesn't she?
Yes.
Because she's quite nice to Antoine, but it seems to be just so he won't tell the father about you know, the other man and things like that. So it's an interesting portrayal of the family, you know?
I think it also also critiques the educational system, school system at the time, just how poorly that teacher treats him and basically picks him out as a target. Because, like, you have that opening sequence, sequence kind of at the very beginning, where the kids are passing around a pinup calendar, and the teacher just happens to catch Antoine holding it. But it wasn't Antoine who took it out in the first place, and a bunch of other kids are involved. And that's something that happens, like, so this is, like, a interesting critique of, you know, the school system, which Truffaut had languished in himself. It's an interesting exploration of family dynamics. It's a coming of age story where you see, and he's coming of age too soon, but because of his circumstances. And the thing that I take the most away from this is how it explores how children are misunderstood, and how there's that concept, which is just absolutely awful, that persisted for many years about how children should be seen and not heard. But there's, like, this natural distrust of children, expecting them just to lie about things. And yes, children do lie, but, like, also adults do too, you know? I remember being a child, and I remember telling adults something was wrong and they not believing me. So when I watch The 400 Blows, I connect to that aspect of how children are misunderstood. Like, they're taking in all of this information and all this experience, and they're being molded into the adults they're going to be, and how you treat them as children will affect that. So this is also a warning to adults: treat children better, which is something that the popular reception to this film afterwards, people were just horrified by these parents and how they treated the son.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because even the stepfather at one point, I think he's talking to the headmaster or something, and he says, I think that doesn't the headmaster say something like, sometimes the old ways are the best? And the parent says, well, we're not like that. But then later on, you do see him walk into the classroom and just, you know, smack him over the head, basically. So you sort of see that neglect and abuse that he goes through.
And the fact that they're so willing to ship him off to, at first, the summer camp, they want to get rid of him for the summer. And then how willing they're trying to get him to just, like, go out to this detention center. But I think it's also interesting too, the mother at one point says, can it be by the seaside? And it was interesting because, okay, Antoine has never seen the ocean. And is that something that his parents have held back from him? Like, if they go on vacation, they don't take him with them, you know? And then you have that scene where he's actually finally at the ocean for the first time in his life. This is a new experience. So, oh my goodness, it breaks my heart, but it also fills me with like some hope that he's going to be okay, you know, in a weird way. Do you get that from this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting with the ending, isn't it? Because I've never been quite sure how to take it, because I think the fact that it freezes and the look on his face is quite inscrutable, isn't it? I don't know, because you got the long sequence of him running, and that feels quite liberating. And then ending on a freeze frame is always, I've never been quite sure. Obviously, the interesting thing is you can follow the story, can't you? Because Truffaut did return to the character.
Yes.
But yeah, the ending I've always felt unsure about.
So somewhere I had read that him looking directly into the camera and it freezing was his call to the audience to judge him. How dare you judge me for what I've done and what, you know, what you've seen in the past 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, I think that's fair because, like you say, you get the sense, don't you, that like the education system is part of it, that mm-hmm. this is not really a system set up for a child like Antoine to thrive in, you know?
Correct, yeah.
I think a lot of people find that relatable. You know, hopefully that's different now because times have changed. There's a bit more awareness now that not every student needs to be dealt with in exactly the same way and so on right. and so forth. But I think a lot of people will still kind of key into that. I definitely felt sorry for him from the get-go for the reason you mentioned. I think he's singled out a bit unfairly by the teacher, isn't he, with that yes. calendar. But also many other things in the film too. Like when his parents are arguing, I think he's led down on his bed, isn't he? And the camera stays on his face and that's just no situation for a child to be in, you know?
And just the conditions he's living in, like yeah, he sleeps so in a sleeping bag and yeah. his mother's like, oh, he likes to sleep in a sleeping bag, you know? And or they sit down for dinner and they just have like a bowl of broth. I mean, I'm sure they eat something else afterwards because it kind of, I think it's maybe just the first course or something, I hope, because they just look like water in a bowl.
Well, I was wondering that because I was wondering how much money the family actually had, because it seemed like the mother yeah. had some nice clothes to go out in and stuff.
Yes.
But like you say, the living conditions were really cramped. I think it goes back to that, like I said, there's this kind of interesting blend in the film where when he's indoors, it's cramped, it's claustrophobic. When he's outside, that's when his spirit really soars, you know?
Yeah.
I think he's quite a misunderstood boy, isn't he? Because like there are other scenes too, like he gets caught with the typewriter, but mm-hmm. when he gets caught, he's actually trying to bring it back, isn't he? You know, yeah. it's not like he got caught taking it out. He was going to put it back. Also, when he gets caught for cheating at school, and it seems to me like he was inspired by Balzac. He wasn't trying to just plagiarize it word for word. At least that's why I took it.
I wasn't sure how to take that because I've read different interpretations that he just straight up plagiarized and then because he just really loved Balzac and then others were just like, maybe he's a literary genius and they're just overlooking this because yeah. it's just too good.
My feeling was at least the teacher could have said, okay, well, you've gone too far, but it's good that you're reading this. It's good that you're inspired. You know, it could have been handled differently.
But he's just a jerk.
Yeah. But also when you know, like, Antoine seems to do some housework without being asked to do that. And, you know, yes. that doesn't always happen with children of that age.
That's the thing about his characters. And also, you know, what I don't care sometimes is how there's a binary between, like, good and evil. Like, okay, you're wholly good or you're wholly bad. Sometimes you're just both, you know. So he's got some aspects of him that, you know, here's... you know, some mischievous things that he's done in that yeah. interview that they have with him at the detention center. He's talking about how he stole money from his grandmother because he was just sure she was going to die soon, you know, things like that. But there's a lot of good in this kid. And you could tell that it's just not tapped into because the adults just don't trust him, you know. Oh, it's frustrating. Yeah.
And I think there are some really nice, poignant moments too, aren't there? Like when he cries in the back of the prison van, for instance. Mm. That's really good. I think in general, Jean-Pierre Léaud is very good in the role, isn't he?
And oh, he is.
He has quite a sympathetic appearance. I think Truffaut had said that, it's interesting how everybody talks about it as Truffaut's autobiographical film. But I think Truffaut's kind of said, well, Jean-Pierre Léaud brought a lot to it. Because he right. said that Truffaut saw Antoine as more fragile, wilder, less aggressive. And then Jean-Pierre gave him health, aggressiveness, courage. So that's kind of interesting to me. You got to think about how much the actors bring to it too. It's definitely a very spontaneous like feeling to his performance, isn't there? Which I think yeah. fits well with the new wave vibe. Yeah.
No, you're right. Like, because Truffaut, when he was young and he was, you know, experiencing his misadventures, he was a lot more quiet and reserved. And he saw the opposite in Jean-Pierre Léaud. So he added that element to Antoine's character. You know, this kid is a lot more outspoken and outgoing than Truffaut himself. So you get that element of it. And what's interesting, too, is I was thinking of Daryl Hickman, who he was a child actor back in the day, like at MGM, and he wrote this book about acting. He's an acting coach now, and he talks about how child actors are unique in the fact that they can be out of control and in full command. They know that they're acting, but they're so in tune with their natural sense of self and their instincts, more so than an adult who would more question that or more try to police that within themselves. They end up becoming much more natural actors. So you kind of get that sense with Jean-Pierre Léaud that he's kind of like, maybe unconscious of the fact that he's just like acting and he's just, you know, having fun in a way, and he's just being himself, but channeling it through this character. It just comes off really natural. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the stories I'd heard about that was that scene with the psychologist towards the end of the film.
Oh, yes.
Where you don't see the psychologist, of course, you just see Antoine. Mm-hmm. I think what had happened is that the actress they'd chosen for that role was not in Paris when the scene was filmed. So what they planned to do was they would go back in and film her side of it and add the reverse shots in later. And so they just said to Leo, you know, they just gave him a sense of what the questions would be. And he was asked to just kind of riff and improvise his answers. Truffaut said, I wanted his vocabulary, his hesitations, his total spontaneity. And then what happened is when they saw the rushes from that scene, they really liked the effect of it. And they gave up the idea of actually going back to film with the actress. And they just put a voice in instead. And I think that scene works really well in the finished film. So I think it was a good choice.
I agree.
That spontaneity, maybe, like we say, the sort of new wave traits, the new wave characteristics, I think that's part of it. What do you think are the most obvious, like, new wave aspects of the film that we could point to?
You know what's actually really interesting is that final sequence. I read that the cinematographer had a camera in a truck, and the truck just kind of follows.
I wondered about that.
Yeah. Jean-Pierre Léaud to the beach, and I thought that was so French New Wave. Just like do something totally different with the camera. Do a very, very long shot, something just that even seems maybe a little too long, you know? And then that the freeze frame at the end where, like, Antoine's kind of breaking the fourth wall and looking into the camera and it freezes and it kind of zooms in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Those are just things that you don't, I mean, I mean, obviously you have, like, tracking shots in films and people have done different things, but I thought that was just an interesting example of how in French New Wave you would do different things with the camera. You would do different things with editing. You might do little short little cuts here, but then you might do a very, very long sequence. I'm just thinking of, like, the Jean-Luc Godard film Weekend. There's a very dramatic, like, car crash traffic sequence that goes on way, way too long. And in a film, you wouldn't see that. Like, in a film maybe from, you know, the golden age of Hollywood, you wouldn't take that long to show a car crash sequence. But in French New Wave, there's like all this experimentation. So I thought that was interesting. And then what I think is interesting too, especially about Truffaut and his in 400 Blows, is how he takes like small moments and really highlights them. I mean, there's this one sequence that I'm just obsessed with. In addition to the whole taking out the trash sequence where you have Antoine taking out the trash, and it takes a long time with that. There's a scene in the classroom with one child, and all of these actors, I think, had, like, auditioned to be Antoine, and they were put in the classroom and given little roles. The teacher is transcribing something on the chalkboard, and he has this little notebook, and he keeps messing up each page. Like, the ink gets all over his hands. He messes up a word. He tears it, and he keeps going. And Truffaut keeps the camera on him for a good long while until he completely runs out of paper. And I'm just like, you would not see that in, like, hardly any other film. But I love that small moment. It kind of shows the exasperation of this child in this pressure to be perfect. Like, he has to transcribe what the teacher's transcribing onto the chalkboard perfectly. And he keeps having to start over until he just has to give up because there's no paper left. So I think those things, I think, are an example of how Truffaut is just such a different filmmaker.
Yeah, no, I think, and very authentic and truthful. A lot of these things that they did, whether it's shooting on location or using non-professional actors, untrained actors, it's interesting because it kind of, it does suit the vibe they're going for. And there's also kind of an economic thing too, where they couldn't afford to shoot in the studios, you know, they couldn't afford big stars. So there was kind of a nice overlap where it kind of suited their purposes artistically as well as commercially. And I think they were working at a time when they just had these lightweight handheld cameras that had come along.
Right. And they had small crews too. You didn't have like a big, You don't have a studio system. You don't have the studio system machine just grinding its gears for you. And you had like all these resources. You were working on a shoestring budget with a small crew and these unknowns, you know, and they were doing really great things.
And of course, because they were rebelling against how polished like studio films were. So it all kind of fit. The other thing I was going to point to was, I think Truffaut and Godard and a lot of those people, you know, Rivette, Roma, Chabrol, etc., like you've already alluded to, they were big cinephiles, weren't they? Mm-hmm. And they were from a generation that adored films. And it was kind of seen as being like a young person's hobby, I think, at that time. I've seen some stat that, like, in Paris in the 50s, 43% of spectators in cinemas were under the age of 24 or something like that. But you can see that in this film and in a lot of the other films, can't you? Their intense love of films. Like, just a few little things here. Like, that scene where, one of my favorite scenes in the film is when you're overhead and you see them, they're like running through the streets or something, aren't they? It's some kind of gym class, it looks like. And the pupils kind of peel off from the group one by one, you know. And apparently that's an homage to a Jean Vigo film, Zero de Conduit.
Ah, okay.
One of the schoolboys is called Chabrol, so it's obviously a nod to Claude Chabrol. Mm-hmm. I think Jeanne Moreau has a cameo as a woman walking with a dog at one point.
Yes. And I think the guy who's following her is an actor, too. I was looking him up. So, like, yeah, there's, like, little cameos.
But, like, that's a big part of the appeal of the French New Wave, isn't it? It's the nods to other films. And I suppose in this film, it's the film they go to see with the family, I think, is a Jacques Rivette film. So it's kind of like this in-joke aspect to it, you know?
And then Jacques Demy has a cameo as a police officer. You see him very briefly. And then I had read that Jean-Luc Godard did some sort of, like, voiceover, but I don't know where that is in the film, do you know?
No, I've heard it, though. I don't know exactly where it is. But, okay. There was that kind of, you know, I think Truffaut had, did he write the treatment or something for Breathless? So at this early stage of the French New Wave, they were very collaborative, weren't they? And then they would kind of go to separate ways a bit later on, is what it seems like. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that self-reflexivity is a very big New Wave characteristic, definitely.
Yes.
Just also the sense that it's not a plot-driven film in the same way, because it's quite, how would you describe it? It's kind of like episodic in some ways, isn't it? Like, there are some scenes in The 400 Blows, you could almost, you know, some of the, like that scene with the children running through the streets and the gym class, you could almost put that in a different point of the film. It wouldn't make much difference. You know, the narrative almost is quite elliptical or something. Does that make sense?
I like what you said earlier about it being slice of life. It definitely is. And yeah, it's definitely chapters of his story, but it's not, you know, a cohesive plot. But it does also make sense in how it continues.
Because it's linear. You know, yeah.
Yeah, it's linear. It's chronological. But yeah, it's more slice of life.
And like I said earlier, I really love that dichotomy that exists between like inside and outside, because like inside is generally quite static, isn't it? Like the camera's quite stable, and then, you know, like we said, his bedroom space is tiny. It seems like he's sleeping in a hallway or something, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a sleeping bag.
Sometimes he's even behind bars, like, you know.
Yes, that happens a lot in the last quarter of the film. You see the bars of like him, you know, in the back of the truck when they're taking him away, or when he's actually in the detention center. So that pops up a lot. I like what you said about the difference between indoors and outdoors, because indoors there's so much chaos, and it's so he's in a space with these adults, and it's almost always dangerous. But his freedom is outside when he's, you know, playing hooky with his best friend, when he escapes the football game and then runs to the ocean. Like, freedom is outdoors, and indoors is almost like a form of prison. And it doesn't matter where he is, in the detention center or not. So, yeah, that's an interesting observation. I totally see that.
Because when he's outside, it seems like the camera is much more mobile. Yes. It seems like there's a bit more distance from him. Sometimes we see him from overhead, don't we?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point. And then, I mean, you have like explosive scenes like him, you know, the Balzac shrine, you know, in flames. And he also kind of discovers the truth outdoors more so than inside. Like, you know, when he finds his mother having an affair with another man, that happens outdoors. And then he has to keep that secret indoors when they meet up later.
I also like the music as well, because the music, I don't know how you describe it, it's kind of like air, it's kind of airy and light. Yeah. It kicks it whenever you go to an outdoor location. That's when it seems to come in, doesn't it?
Oh, that's a good observation. Yeah.
That feeling of freedom. I think it kind of supplements that. Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, when he breaks, how do you take the ending? So do you think at the end he's kind of broken free of the adult world? I just wonder what's going to happen the next day. You know, what's going to happen later? Do you think he's kind of transitioned? If the film is a coming of age, do you think he has come of age by the end of it?
I think he's come of age in terms of this aspect of his life, and I think he's got another chapter coming. It has to be in between him, like this, like he's maybe like, what, 12 years old? And I think in the following film, he's 17. So there's like this time period where he has to discover himself and break free, become his own person. So I kind of wish Truffaut had made a film just about that. That period, yeah. That would have been interesting. But yeah, no, I feel hope at the end when he just goes under that fence, breaks free, runs to the beach. I feel hope. Like, I feel like he's going to be okay. He just has to get through this time period, become an adult, and he'll be fine. And even if I don't keep in mind, like, the following films to come, which I haven't seen very many of them, but, like, I don't know. I always get a sense of hope at the end. Or maybe that's just me putting that onto it emotionally because I want there to be hope.
Do you think it's inviting? It's purposefully a bit ambiguous, isn't it?
So yeah, I think it's great because then the audience can interpret it as they want. Like, you could interpret it as like he's terrified that he'll go back to his parents, or that he'll be stuck here for a long time, or this is going to be a cycle where he can't escape. Someone else might look at it and think, "Wow, this is a new chapter in his life, a fresh start."
I always feel hopeful when he's running. I really love that elongated run. I think it's a great sequence. And then it's the end. I'm always like, well, what does that mean? I'm not sure. Like you said, it's interesting about the influence or the like, kind of the afterlife of the 400 Blows. So Truffaut returned to the character several times. So yeah, Antoine and Colette is a short film from 1962, which is the one you referred to, I think, where he's 17 years old. He's living by himself. And then he falls in love with the Colette of the title. Then later films are Stolen Kisses, which I think is 1968, I want to say. He's kind of going between different jobs in that film. And then Bed and Board and Love on the Run. I haven't seen those final two. But that's a nice, I think you can get a box set of the whole saga.
Okay.
You know? So it's nice for the return to the character. Do you feel like this is a film that just generally, it seems to me like it's had a big influence on, whenever you see a coming of age narrative, I feel like somewhere in there is the kind of DNA of the 400 Blows, if that makes sense. Films like Boys in the Hood, I've heard compared to the 400 Blows, and I can sort of see that.
Yeah, I can see that too. I think what Truffaut does well in this is he shows that you can tell a story about a child and have it be interesting to adults, because there is some misconception, and you know, some misconception now and then, that if it's about children, it's for children. But this really shows that you could tell a very interesting story about a child and adults would be very interested in it, because it's very well done and it's just a very interesting story about an individual. So I think that opens up things to come. But yeah, I'm not really sure about influence. I'd love to see more connections of like how this film directly influenced other filmmakers. I know that there are, you know, plenty of filmmakers like Tarantino and Scorsese that love the French New Wave. I believe like Quentin Tarantino's production company is called A Band Apart, like the Band of Outsiders, the Jean-Luc Godard film. So, you know, definitely the New Wave in general has like influenced filmmakers to come.
Yeah, I had a quick look at the on the IMDb page for the 400 Blows. You can click on Movie Connections.
I love doing that.
Yeah. They've got 98 films listed under like influenced by the 400 Blows.
Nice.
And it's films like Once Upon a Time in America, Moonlight was listed. With some of them, it doesn't specify what the connection is. With some of them, it says, you know, this film has a shot at the end which freeze frames, as in the 400 Blows. But yeah, I'd point people to that. In terms of Tarantino, I think he actually mentions the 400 Blows in his new novel, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood book. I'm trying to remember this now. It was a couple of weeks ago I read the book. The character of Cliff, which is Brad Pitt's character from the film, you discover in the book that he's actually a big foreign language cinema fan. Every Sunday he goes to see a non-English film at the cinema. But you find out that he didn't like The 400 Blows, I believe. He didn't buy it. He didn't buy that the kid would be into Balzac and things like that. So it's interesting that we're saying, actually, this is drawn from Truffaut's own experience, you know. But I don't know if that's representing Tarantino's perspective or if it's just through the prism of his character.
I mean, so I believe the Balzac thing because maybe not at age 12, but when I was in my early teens, I was really into like Henry James and and Thomas Hardy and Louisa May Alcott and Jane Austen. I was like, so it's totally possible.
Yeah, I think so too. Just in terms of the standing of the 400 Blows quickly. So a couple of things. In 2018, the film was voted, there was a BBC Culture poll for the greatest non-English films. And The 400 Blows was voted the eighth greatest of all time, which I thought was super interesting. That was a critics poll. And then the Sight and Sound magazine 2012, they did a 10-yearly poll. We're coming up for the next one in 2022. But the 2012 one, the last one, The 400 Blows was listed at 39th on the list of the greatest films of all time, as judged by the critics they invited. And then they also do a director's poll, and it was 13th on that list. So you get the sense of how important it has been for filmmakers from that, yeah. I think you can look at who voted for it, and Sam Mendes put it in his top 10 and things like that. Some of the notable directors too.
Wow.
So yeah, I suppose just in short, people should see the film, shouldn't they? I think if you see The 400 Blows, not only will you enjoy it, but you'll feel like it's a nice one to tick off the list, isn't it, of great films to see, I think.
And it was an instant hit when it came out too. Like I read that Truffaut had sold it for how much he made for it exactly to a United States distributor. I don't know what distributor it was, but he sold it for like $50,000 American, and that's how much it cost to actually make the movie. So he already got his return on his investment even before it was released at Cannes, where it premiered. And then it was such a huge hit in France that it was like sold to different markets. And he said that the only market it didn't do well in was Italy, because it reminded people of other Italian neorealist films. So that like, they were like, oh, this isn't anything new, but it just was new and fresh for other countries and like other audiences. So this was an instant hit, and it just continues to be respected as a classic. So it's got a really strong, it's got like a really strong foundation. So this is one, like if you have like a top 100 list of movies to watch before you die, this has to be on it.
Yeah, this is a good one to
go and watch, definitely. It's just a superb film. It really is.
Yeah, very well said, I think. Was there anything else, Raquel? I feel like you mentioned Italian films there. Wasn't there a film that reminded you of The 400 Blows you wanted to mention?
Yes.
Is that right?
So The Shoe Shine from 1946, it's directed by Vittorio De Sica, who famously directed The Bicycle Thieves. This is an early neorealist film. It was the first film to win a Best International Oscar. It was the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar back in the day. Before it was a competitive category. When it was a competitive category, the first film was La Strada. But before that, for like almost a decade, there were honorary Oscars for Best Foreign Language Film. And this is the first one to win it. And this is a story about these two young boys. They shine shoes for a living, and they're trying to get enough money to buy a horse. And what happens is these adults who basically say, hey, if you do this for us, we'll give you some money, and it's enough money for them to buy the horse, but it implicates them in a crime that they weren't actually involved in, and they get sent to a juvenile detention center. It's really depressing. It's completely different from The 400 Blows, but what it does, I think, that's similar to The 400 Blows is that shows you the perspective of these misunderstood kids who have genuinely good intentions, but get caught up in the world of these kind of corrupt adults. And I thought that was really interesting. And I couldn't find any connection between Truffaut and this film. I did read that when Truffaut was very young, he entered a contest about the bicycle thieves, and he actually won a bicycle. So he was really interested in that film. Maybe he had watched Shoeshine as well, but I think it's interesting if you watch The 400 Blows and you want to see something similar and maybe something with some historical significance. Shoeshine from 1946 is interesting to watch. And also, if you're interested, my friend Kate Gabrielle, who's a big François Truffaut fan, she and I got together in New York City and we just sat and talked for a long time about François Truffaut, and it's on my YouTube channel. So if you want to just hear a Truffaut fan gush about her favorite film director, I recommend watching that.
Yeah, that sounds good. This was from a while ago, was it?
Yeah.
Was that pre-pandemic?
Pre-pandemic.
And I think a lot of people listening will have seen, if they're on Twitter especially, I think people will know Kate's designs, won't they? Because she is very creative. Is it her, I can't remember her website address or...
It's just kategabrielle.com. She's also on other platforms. But yeah, no, she does like t-shirt designs and original prints and enamel pins and all sorts of things. If you're a fan of classic movies or even foreign movies, she has some French New Wave themed stuff there too. Yeah, she has a lot and her designs are fantastic.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, Raquel, just to round off, what are you up to online these days and where can people find you?
I'm I'm everywhere these days. So I have a blog, outofthepastblog.com, which is focused on classic movies. And I have another one, kelmovies.com, which is about new films. And I focus on independent movies, LGBTQ, foreign language films, that kind of thing. I won't be reviewing big blockbusters. It's really the smaller films I'm interested in. I have a YouTube channel, Out of the Past, and I'm on Instagram, Kel Movies, and I'm on Twitter as at Raquel Stetcher, and I just got verified.
Very nice. Yeah.
So follow me on there.
Great stuff. Thanks, Raquel. A pleasure as ever to have you on the podcast for the first time in a little while. Yeah. Hope it's not too
Thank
long
you.
Until the next time. Yeah, listeners, you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at CKJSweeney. The Movie Palace is at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter. Also on Facebook and Instagram. But that's all for today, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Frame to Frame.
I do find that on Please Mr. Kennedy, it always tickles me when Adam Driver pops up.
Yeah.
I think that the ridiculous insertions that he has in the song is what makes it...
Outer space. Outer space. All that.
It's just absurd.
I just love it.
Is very kitsch. And then you've got that.
Yeah, I just love the... Oh no! he just throws in things like that. Uh-oh! It's just great. This is the first film I saw Adam Driver in, and he's only in it for about 5 minutes, and he almost steals the entire movie. That's how great, what a great actor he is, although obviously one must credit the Coen brothers with the brilliant attention to detail in the music and the writing and the direction, as you'd expect.
Yeah.
Cerebral Jukebox.
My friend had a Nimrod t-shirt. Well, quite a few people I knew had Nimrod t-shirts.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of the famous one. And I think I must have seen that album cover every day.
Yeah.
For 2 years.
To me, I think Nimrod could be the perfect rock album. I don't think there's a better all-round rock album than Nimrod. American Idiot is exceptional, but there's something about Nimrod that has... It ticks so many boxes and has so much diversity on it. I think it could be the best album ever made.
Pretty Fly, a 90s nostalgia podcast.
People like me have benefited from that for generations. Now
centuries.
That that's being challenged, yeah, century, 100%. You've got people that are understanding, and I'm not ashamed of who I am or where I'm from, but that, you know, doesn't mean that I can't sit back and say, hey, other people catching up ain't a bad thing.
Absolutely. I just want to remind the listeners, this is a Rugrats podcast.
This has got deep and serious at the moment.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello, everyone. This is Tony, network chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.